is not rescission between you and me. The real issue is whether third parties here are affected.
So I think the law is quite clear, Your Honor, that third parties stand in the shoes of the seller for purposes of enforcing the contract. They do not, as in any third-party beneficiary arrangement, a third party would obtain no greater rights than the seller. So a third party standing in the shoes of the seller would be no better off with respect to a rescission claim. Now, it may be different if there was reliance by a third party upon certain language or upon a transaction, but that's not the case here. So that a third party has no greater rights than the seller, People's Gas, regardless of whether People's Gas is defunct or not. So if I have a right to rescind a transaction that we make, despite the fact that you've gone out of business, a third party standing in your shoes, Your Honor, would be subject to the same defenses that People's Gas would be. So in this case, the third party gains no greater rights.
How did Columbia Propane get into this act?
Well, Columbia Propane, Your Honor, purchased a parcel of this 1.4-acre site in 1958. So Columbia Propane owned an adjoining piece of property. And it's conceivable that there was some migration of contamination onto their property in that period, 1958 to 1960, when Wisconsin Gas bought the property. Wisconsin Gas then, in turn, sold its parcel. It only held it 2 years, sold its parcel to Columbia Propane. So Columbia Propane, in 1962, became the owner of the entire parcel. I do want to emphasize, I want to get back to the asset purchase agreement here. The asset purchase agreement in paragraph 1, this is 1A and 1B, Milwaukee agrees, subject to the representations and warranties of People's Gas, it agrees to assume outstanding liabilities. Again, subject to means conditioned upon the representations and warranties. The representations and warranties in the asset purchase agreement appear at paragraph 4A, B, and C. The critical representation and warranty here is in paragraph 4C. In paragraph 4C, People's Gas represented and warranted that all of the liabilities being transferred to Wisconsin Gas, whatever they might be, were either adjusted for on the balance sheet or were covered by insurance. That also appears again in paragraph 7A of the asset purchase agreement. It states that the obligations of Wisconsin Gas are subject to the accuracy of the representations and warranties of People's Gas at the time of closing. So what was occurring here was that Wisconsin Gas was not assuming any risk in this transaction because the liabilities that it was assuming were either adjusted for on the balance sheet or it received a representation and warranty, which was a condition of their assumption of liability, that there would be insurance coverage for any liability of People's Gas. And we would submit, Your Honor, that the seller cannot make a representation and warranty that it has insurance coverage for unknown liabilities. One in good faith could not possibly represent to another party, I have insurance coverage for any claim that might arise out of something I've done in the last 40 years, regardless of whether I know about it and regardless of the magnitude of that liability.
Now, all this depends on the fact that if Wisconsin Gas Company, let's take it out of corporate law. Just mystery.
Straight contract.
The company, Peoples, sells to Mr. Smith. Mr. Smith owns the property for a while and then sells to Columbia Propane. Right?
Okay.
And Mr. Smith, who owned it for a couple of years, did nothing wrong. Didn't do any activity on the property, didn't cause any leakage or anything. If there was leakage, it was because of what Peoples did originally.
Correct.
Would Mr. Smith be liable to Columbia?
As a matter of contract law?
Well, there's just a deed of the property.
Mr. Smith would not be liable, unless there was some CERCLA liability.
Well, that's what I'm asking you. Is this CERCLA liability?
Well, no, I believe, and I don't pretend to be an expert in CERCLA, nor did CERCLA come into this case, but I believe under CERCLA there would have to be some participation by Mr. Smith. If he were totally a passive owner, I don't believe he would have CERCLA liability.
So this case is being handled on the basis that the only reason there's liability is because the gas company by contract assumed it from people.
That's what's being alleged. The only basis for liability is contract, and it's our position that under this contract, the representations and warranties made by People's Gas could not extend to unknown liability because they promised that they had insurance. And they could only promise that they had insurance if they knew about their liabilities. And there are two liabilities mentioned in this agreement. They both appear in paragraph 7B. There was an accident on the property in 1958 and another one in 1959. Those were contingent liabilities, so they could not be adjusted for on the balance sheet. And that is precisely why there was this exception. They're either on the balance sheet or we have insurance. Now, People's could say we had insurance for those two incidents because they knew about them. They can't tell the buyer, they can't tell Wisconsin Gas they've got insurance coverage for a tort that they don't even know exists or what the magnitude might be.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Casey.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm John Casey, and I've got issue number two. This court, by the way, in denying some motions with respect to abbreviating the brief, set forth in detail the two issues which were picked up in hyc verba from the appellant's brief. And the issue number two is, paraphrased, even if the contract language is ambiguous, which, of course, we dispute, do policy considerations preclude an asset buyer from being held to have assumed the buyer's undisclosed, unknown, and unlimited tort liabilities based on that ambiguous language? This takes me, and I think the court, back to Corporation 101 in the first or maybe second year of law school, and takes us back to over 100 years of law in this state, going back to at least 1896 in Pennison versus Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul Railroad, where the law in Wisconsin has been for all of that time that a corporation that purchased the assets of another does not succeed to the ownership, does not by succeeding to the ownership of that property, assume the obligations of the transferor corporation. That's the law that was cited in the Seventh Circuit decision of Leonidas back in 1977. That's the general rule that this court cited in Tift versus Forge back in 82. And, of course, it's the law that was cited by this court in Amstead in 1985. The Leonidas Court, Seventh Circuit, and this court in both Tift and Amstead recognized the general rule. They also recognized the four well-known exceptions to the general rule where liability will be imposed on the successor corporation, where there's an agreement, either express or implied, where there's consolidation or merger, where essentially it's a mere continuation, or where there's fraud.
I'm sorry, what was the last one?
The last one is fraud, where there's fraud to attempt to escape liabilities. This case involves half of exception number one. It's only the only issue before this court that I'm addressing relates to, assuming there is some ambiguity, where there is an express agreement. I'm not talking about implied agreement. We're only talking about express agreements. Where there is an express agreement and there is ambiguity, should this court, as a matter of public policy, determine that as between the innocent transferor, who had no knowledge, could have no knowledge, of the tortious conduct of the transferring corporation, should that entity be held liable or be excused in the context of ambiguous language? Your Honor.
Mr. Casey, is there also an issue here, at least to some extent, involving a claim of asking to amend the pleadings to address that fraud exception that you just mentioned?
There was an issue below with respect to at the trial court level, there was an effort to amend the pleading to assert a fraud claim. Judge Conway in Wood County said it's too late, wasn't going to allow that. The Court of Appeals decision in its reversal of Judge Conway purported to send that back for reconsideration at the trial court level. But that issue is not before this court. We are taking the position that, regardless of this late Johnny-come-lately fraud claim, that as a matter of law, either Wisconsin Gas prevails because the contract is unambiguous, or that as a matter of public policy, this Court should adopt the law that it can have no liability in this circumstance. It's also true that at the trial court level, this case attempted to involve exceptions numbers 2 and 3, that is, the mere continuation or the de facto merger. That was Judge Conway at the trial court level ruled against the plaintiff, Columbia. That was not taken up on appeal. That's a dead duck. So our position here is this Court can finally and fully resolve this case today or when it renders its decision by determining either A or B in favor of the appellant, Wisconsin Gas.
Why didn't Madison Gas implicitly assume liability?
Why did Wisconsin Gas not?
Why didn't it implicitly assume liability?
Because you talk about the difference between express or implied. Under Wisconsin law, going back to Schrader versus Alice Chalmers, the law is that where there is an express agreement that addresses the subject, that express agreement shall control, and we will not imply terms contrary to the express agreement. And we cited that case in our brief. Now, it is true that where a contract is silent on a subject, such as assumption of liabilities, then the Court can look to other conduct to see whether or not it is implied. But where it is addressed, that the Court is not allowed to step in and imply terms.
Where it's addressed and it is ambiguous, why isn't there an argument that the ambiguity then raises inferences or implications, therefore an argument can be advanced that even when the issue is addressed, if it is addressed in ambiguous terms, reasonable inferences can be drawn which result in implied assumption.
Well, I think you're getting to the policy argument that we're asking this Court to adopt, and that is, under these circumstances, assuming there is ambiguity, then we want this Court to do what it has done for time immemorial in the context of tort cases, give us some judicial gloss that tells us how contracts are to be interpreted, what tort law is. This is, I think, the important thing for this Court to do is not get bogged down in products liability law, which is a different genre altogether. And the hypotheticals that like to be issued always involve some poor person being injured by a product. And this Court, for example, in Amstead with then Justice Abrahamson and Justice Babich and Chief Justice Heffernan, of course, dissented in Fish v. Amstead and tried to accept and wanted to have this Court adopt, the State of Wisconsin adopt, the product line exception. That's not the law in Wisconsin yet. And then Justice Abrahamson, you talked in that case about how tort law does evolve to respond to current conditions. That's what we're asking this Court to do, is respond to the current conditions. Now, Justice Abrahamson, you also said in that dissent that it doesn't matter what the contract language says when you look at it from a third-party standpoint. Mm-hmm. And that simply, Your Honor, is not, cannot be the law in Wisconsin that a purchaser of assets cannot structure its contract so as to immunize itself from subsequent liability to third parties by appropriate contract language. Our position is, first, that the contract language was fully appropriate and did accomplish the task. But secondly, if it is ambiguous, of course, then let's go over to the indemnity parallel that we talked about in our briefs. In indemnification situations, which is what this is, Peoples is essentially saying, Peoples, now guised as Columbia Propane, is saying, we did wrong. We are the tortfeasor, but we have a contract that allows us to be indemnified by you, indemnitor.
I have a question whether this case falls under the exception for continuation. Did Wisconsin Gas, in effect, take over Peoples Gas? Did Wisconsin Gas do on the property what Peoples Gas had done on the property? And if you hadn't changed the sign, would people think it was still Peoples Gas?
Well, Your Honor, you're, of course, addressing specifically one of the exceptions. And that's an exception that was addressed at the trial court level and has been abandoned by Columbia Propane before this court. Now, do you want? I can go outside of the record and tell you what I think was going on at the time. But in fact, I'm not outside the record.
But it's abandoned. But what about the? Isn't it brought up again in the constructive trust, constructive fraud issue? That in effect, what you were doing is buying the stock, continuing the business, and therefore you should be held liable.
No, that's not even the fact. And there is. These facts are in the record. In fact, the Public Service Commission determination with respect to this transaction is described in the appendix. The fact is Wisconsin Gas, the gas pipeline was being extended up towards Marshfield. Wisconsin Gas wanted, let me back up, Columbia Propane, then Peoples, had a small pipeline system up in Marshfield. Wisconsin Gas wanted the franchise. They wanted to get their toe in the door and be the operator. As soon as they got the franchise, 2 years later, they turned around and sold the property. They didn't need this property, and they sold it to Columbia Propane, who already owned the other half of the property. There's no suggestion that this is a mere continuation. The business is different, and most importantly, of course, the owners are different. The stockholders are different.
I have two questions.
May I keep talking if you know my red light's on?
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I have two questions. You were to write the opinion, what would you say is the rule that comes out of this case? And number two, should you prevail, is that the end of this case, or does this go back to either the Court of Appeals or the Circuit Court? You can start with the second one first.
If we prevail under either theory in this court, that should be the end of the case. Certainly the answer is yes. Under either theory, it's the end of the case. Now, I forgot the first one.
The first one is, what kind of rule of law comes out of this case?
Sure.
This is your big chance to write that paragraph.
Okay, I'll draft that paragraph. And my first draft, subject to review by other members of the bench, is that we need not reach the public policy question. Although it is interesting. It's probably, while we sit in our offices in Milwaukee, we always wonder, why did this court take this case? And I suspect it's because of the public policy issues. But we don't think that the court ought to get there. It ought to resolve, as in the first instance, that there is no ambiguity in this contract. But if we want to get to the ambiguity issue, we are asking this court to fashion, as it has all along throughout its career, a rule of law that makes sense in the business context. And a rule of law is, as in the indemnification situation, where there is an innocent transferee and a tortious transferor, but it's completely unknown and undisclosed and with unlimited tort liability, at least under those circumstances, in a written contract context, then, if there is ambiguity, it ought to be resolved in favor of the transferee and against the transferor, as following the typical public policy of this court that, in the first instance, we impose liability on the entity responsible for it, not the innocent transferee, and in the second instance, to enhance free alienability of corporate assets. It's true. I think it's true, and we should be candid here. With 40 years of hindsight, if we looked at this transaction in 2003, could this problem have been better addressed through better drafting? Sure. But in 1960, no one, and this is also undisputed, no one gave a darn about, you read my lips. No one gave a darn about or even heard of ground contamination. And in fact, there wasn't even a theory of liability. So here we've got unknown facts, an unknown liability, an unknown law being imposed on an innocent transferee, and we submit that the law in that instance should be strictly construed against the transferor, narrow confinement, and not allow an innocent transferee to bear who knows what the exposure is. There's millions of dollars, $105,000 transaction, holding the property for 2 years, it doesn't make sense. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Apfield of Godfrey & Kahn, you represent Columbia Propane.
That is correct, Your Honor. May it please the court. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Wisconsin Gas wants this court to fix the first fish exception to the general rule of non-liability for successor corporations. The exception is a universally accepted rule. A purchaser of corporate assets may be held liable for the seller's obligations if it agreed to assume them. Such agreement may be express, it may be implied, but it's a question of intent, and Wisconsin law has well-developed rules for determining intent, rules which the majority of the Court of Appeals followed in this case. This rule of super certainty proposed by Wisconsin Gas is simply a makeshift expedient designed to give to favor one class of persons, purchasers of corporate assets, over all others. There's no need for such a rule. But moreover, the price for such a rule would be high indeed. It, by definition, it avoids inquiry into the actual intent of the parties. It gives the benefit of uncertainty to the party who created it. And it stands to deprive large numbers of injured parties for any remedy, because there is no confining this rule to the rule that they propose to the facts of this case. There is no confining this rule to people who suffer property damage.
You don't think the Court of Appeals opinion accomplished a change in the general rule of asset purchase agreement construction?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not at all. If you look at Fish says, and Fish broke no new ground either. Fish simply recites the four accepted transactions. Fish says, the first exception is an agreement, express or implied. Now, there has been a lot of talk in this case about how the Court of Appeals somehow turned Fish on its head, that it focused on exceptions, and by ambiguities in that exception, somehow implied an affirmative assumption. That simply is not what happened in this case. The Court of Appeals looked at express language in the January 5th agreement, which said we will assume all of the then outstanding obligations, liabilities, contracts, and debts.
Subject to
some very limited exceptions. Now, let's look at that subject to. As I understand Mr. Armstrong's argument, he says that the intent not to assume is clear from paragraph 4C, which, by the way, was contained in the original stock purchase agreement. And he spent a great deal of time talking about how the original stock purchase agreement was not intended to assume all liabilities. Your Honors, I contend that that proposition is absolutely untenable. First, I think that there is a serious question as to whether or not the parties could actually agree to such a situation in light of the statute prevailing at that time, which said you enter into this transaction, you assume all obligations and liabilities as if you had incurred them yourself. Absolutely clear.
If it's a stock deal.
If it's a stock. Which this is not. However, keep in mind that it was intended from the very beginning to be a stock deal with subsequent merger, and only at the last minute was there a change. Now, Mr. Armstrong also suggests that, well, the most likely explanation for that last-minute change is, well, the parties grew uncomfortable with their assurance that there was adequate insurance, and so they necessarily changed it to an asset deal. Well, of course, there is absolutely, positively no support in the record for that proposition. I would suggest to you that the more likely explanation, counsel, there is no direct evidence for this, but the more likely explanation is tax reasons. This, as a general proposition, and keep in mind I am no tax attorney, but as a general proposition, whenever a corporation buys, another corporation, it is advantageous for there to be an asset purchase as long as the purchase price exceeds the book value of the assets, which, in fact, is the case here. That's because you get a new basis, and you get to write it down again. And, in fact, if you look at the order in this case, you can piece two things together. First, the order, the last page of the order, which I believe is App 154, says that the purchaser, Wisconsin Gas, then Milwaukee Gas, can amortize it. But there is also another clue. Actually, it's 157. I was right before, 154. There's another clue there, and on that same page, the court says, but you cannot raise rates. My suspicion, again, only a suspicion, is that Wisconsin Gas knew that this was coming beforehand. They had to recoup their costs somehow, so they made it an asset deal. And keep in mind that at the time they were changing, this is consistent with the representation made by both Wisconsin Gas and Peoples Gas to the PSC that this was a change only in the form of the transaction, and that the effect would remain the same, and that Wisconsin Gas would assume all liabilities.
Why do we get into that historical reconstruction at all? Don't we just stick with interpreting the agreement on its face, at least as a first order of business?
Well, no, actually, as a first order of business, you don't preclude any evidence unless Wisconsin Gas establishes beyond any shadow of a doubt that the contract is unambiguous and incapable of any construction other than its own. But in fact, Your Honor, even if you take what I consider to be that untenable assumption, frankly, I think it's unambiguous in the other direction, but if you took that untenable assumption, I would argue that, in fact, you can still look at that record. And there are a couple of reasons for that. First, if you examine, the agreement itself is not an integrated agreement. It contains no integration clause, and it's expressly conditioned upon PSC approval.
I thought it had language in it rescinding the earlier agreement.
But it did rescind
Doesn't
the earlier.
Doesn't that accomplish the same thing?
No, I don't think so, and for these reasons. It's expressly conditioned on PSC approval. PSC approval, of course, is not just a light switch, yes or no. It has terms and conditions, and it's made on the record. The, one of the two letters that we would like, the court and ultimately a jury to consider was Wisconsin Gas's letter to the PSC. And that letter, that's the very same letter in which it characterized this as merely a change of form and assured the PSC that this would be, that the effect of the transaction would be the same. That very same letter explicitly requested that it be made a part of the record for the specific purpose of obtaining PSC approval. Moreover, if you look at the PSC order, that is, the order that this asset purchase agreement was conditioned on, that PSC order doesn't approve the asset purchase. It actually, if you look at it, it approves the terms and conditions of the November 8th stock purchase agreement. And there's no question that that agreement was applied for and approved, that it would have had, the effect provided for in the statute. And for that reason as well, Your Honor, I think that that you can look at that essentially no matter what. But again,
let me see if I understand your argument.
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt you.
Certainly.
Both you and opposing counsel asked the court to look at the stock agreement. Is that right?
You certainly have to take it into account, yes.
And your opposing counsel says the stock agreement makes it perfectly clear that there's limited liabilities that are being passed under the stock agreement.
That's
right?
What they say, yes.
That's what they say. They say if there's a mistake in that, they're entitled to rescission.
That's what they say.
What I hear you saying, and maybe that's not what you're saying, I hear you saying that under the statute, what statute are you talking about?
I am talking about, this is a 1959 statute, Your Honor, and it is...
After 180?
No, not Chapter 180. It is 196 0.80 sub 1 sub C, which is specifically applicable to stock purchases in utilities.
Okay. You're saying 196.81C at that time required that in a stocks transfer, liability also transferred. Is that what you're saying?
I believe that the way it's phrased, it's a stock transfer. Well, it's a merger, which, of course, would be accomplished first through a stock transfer. And it says what it says. It says the surviving corporation shall assume all liabilities of the other corporation, the selling corporation, as if it had incurred them itself.
Okay. And they can't contract out. That's what you're really saying.
I'm saying that's one of my several arguments, yes.
So it's irrelevant, even if they would read this as a contract out under the stock purchase. You're saying they can't do that under the statute.
That's one of my arguments. I'm saying that's not really what they said, but...
What's your other argument?
Well, my other argument is that, first, if they meant to assume only those liabilities listed on the balance sheet, they would have said so. They didn't say so. It's only a representation and a warranty. It's a representation and a warranty that the books are prepared according to GAAP, which does not require the disclosure of contingent liabilities. If they had meant to say it, they would have said it.
Counsel, before you proceed,
yes.
Clarify an answer you just gave to the Chief. And I'm a little confused about your answer. I don't understand your argument to be one of this is really a merger under the statute. It's subject to the statute.
No.
Construe it that way.
No.
It's an argument that goes to the intent of the parties under the then existing statutory scheme.
That is correct.
You're not saying the asset purchase agreement is a merger.
No. It goes to the intent. And our argument is that they intended the assumption of liabilities here to be essentially the same as the assumption of liabilities would have been in the transaction that they originally contemplated. That's the argument.
You're saying they started as stock. They changed to asset, but they told the Public Service Commission it's the same deal as stock.
Right? The same effect will assume all liabilities.
And then you're saying that under 196.81C, if it's the same deal as stock, they assume all the liabilities.
Well, 196.1C specifically refers to the effect of the transaction. The original application spoke of the effect of the transaction pursuant to that specific section. And then, lo and behold, at the last minute, you have Wisconsin Gas representing that it's a change of form only and the effect would be the same. I think that perhaps the only inference, but certainly the logical, most logical inference, is that they intended the assumption to be the same, particularly in light of the extremely broad general assumption that is contained in paragraph 1B of the agreement.
Well, now, did this one public utility wind up, if it had been a stock transfer, would it have one public utility wound up owning the stock of all of the other public utilities? If it had been a stock transfer, would Wisconsin Gas have wound up owning all of the stock of Peoples?
I believe that is what was contemplated, yes, with a subsequent merger that was also contemplated as part of the deal. If I could for a moment, Your Honors, turn to the public policy arguments. Wisconsin Gas is asking for, a very special rule. And I would contend that neither the rule nor the public policy that they claim supports it can be found anywhere in Fish or anywhere else in the law of Wisconsin. Certainly, the policy cannot be found in Fish itself or the first exception that really is under debate. I mean, the phrase expressly or impliedly agrees seems to me perfectly plainly intended to cover the waterfront of all possible agreements. And there's no bright line distinction between one or the other. You don't have to elect to choose, an express agreement or implied agreement. The ultimate touchstone of any agreement, this agreement or any other agreement that comes before this court, is intent. And intent is a matter for construction and, if necessary, for proof, all according to well-established rules of this Court. There's nothing different about an intent to assume obligations known or unknown. The fact of the matter is parties assume risks, unknown risks, in every contract they take. Every party attempts to minimize the unknown to the extent possible. That's why we have these representations and warranties.
Are you arguing, counsel, that unless the contract expressly agrees not to assume the liabilities, that this Court should say it does, expressly or impliedly?
No, not at all. I'm saying it's a question of intent. Now, I personally believe that the intent is unambiguous on this record, but the Court of Appeals differed with me, and we are willing to live with a remand for a trial.
Well, but why wouldn't you at least say that in support of exception number one, that language is so clear that the only way you can get out, the only way a company like Wisconsin Gas can get out from underneath it is to have the contract expressly state that they do not accept the liability.
Well, I believe that as a matter of fact, that is true here. I think that the primary language of assumption is so broad that is the only implication that arises from it. But that does not require us to change the rule of Fish at all. That's an argument that I make well within the established confines of contract law and Fish. Yeah, I think it's perfectly clear. The Court of Appeals disagreed with us. If your honors would like to rule, however, that it is that it's an unambiguous assumption of liability, we're certainly willing to live with that ruling. The public policy can't be found in Fish itself, nor can the public policy really be found in the so-called rule of strict construction to which they make reference in this case. That rule, if you look at the cases, it was developed for a very specific situation because it was unusual for a party to agree prospectively to indemnify another for actions outside its control. And the ambiguity that those cases confront is an ambiguity about whether, you know, a general and, frankly, usually a boilerplate provision, agreement to indemnify, applies to the indemnity's negligence at all. In this case, as in all cases of an express assumption of liability, there's simply no question. I mean, that is not a question. Clearly, Wisconsin Gas intended to assume some of the liabilities, and that alone takes it outside any policy behind, this very narrow rule of strict construction that they rely on.
Where is that found?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You said clearly Wisconsin Gas intended to accept some of the liability.
Well, Your Honor, in paragraph 1B of the agreement itself, you have 1B is found on Petitioner's Appendix 138. Milwaukee hereby agrees to assume all of the then outstanding debts, obligations, contracts, or liabilities of Peoples Gas provided, and then it lists certain exceptions. That's pretty broad, and there just can't be any question that they were intending in some range of actions to assume those liabilities. And that's why it takes it out of this so-called narrow rule of strict construction. Even the narrow rule of strict construction, however, doesn't prevent you from attempting to prove otherwise. I don't think those cases show that, and they certainly shouldn't hold that at all. Equally important, perhaps more important, is that the proposed super clarity requirement that Wisconsin Gas would like this Court to adopt is really bad public policy. It would give an advantage, possibly an insurmountable advantage, to a buyer who was in a position, who had been in a position to clarify any ambiguity, but apparently failed to do so, over an injured party who obviously had no such opportunity, since the injured party is really a stranger to the agreement that that gave rise to the assumption of liability.
Counsel,
yes.
As you heard and I wrote the dissent favoring the injured innocent party against the corporation that might have done something or maybe just held liable anyway between two parties. But I'm very concerned also that we not merge the rules related to asset and stock purchases.
Yes.
Having represented people in a number of transactions that deal with this, there is a difference. And it's an important difference in the law, and it's an important difference in the real world, whether you're buying stock or asset. And it matters on any number of levels, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not interested in having a rule here or having the court do a rule that would eliminate that difference. I think that would be contrary to the common law and contrary to the basic tenets of the common law in this area and contrary to the corporation code. On the other hand, this is a hard case because you've got to, for our purposes at the moment, an innocent party who buys this property and has no chance to do anything other than just get socked with a strict liability, what looks like a strict liability issue, right? Undisturbed.
Well, I'm following you so far, although I would disagree with some of the characterizations.
Well, you can disagree with that. That's mm-hmm. okay, and you can tell me the disagreement. But what you also have to tell me is if we would hold for you, wouldn't that just blow the asset stock distinction out of existence?
Absolutely not.
Okay, tell me why you disagree with my statement, then tell me why not.
Okay. If you wouldn't mind, Your Honor, could I reverse it and tell you why not? The reason is it's so easy to fall within a pure asset purchase agreement. You know, seller hereby agrees to sell assets, buyer agrees to buy. It is expressly understood that we assume no liabilities whatsoever, period. Easy. Easy as pie. That's not what happened here. That doesn't remotely resemble what happened here. There's, in black and white, there's an assumption of liabilities. We can argue about the periphery, the precise reach of that, but that's really a fairly mundane issue. It doesn't violate the rule of fish. We're trying to determine the intent of the parties.
You're saying that this is not an asset agreement. If you really look at it, it looks like a hybrid, an animal that doesn't fit stock or asset.
Well,
what you say?
No, my argument, I agree that in fact, you know, it does have, it comes awfully close to a stock purchase agreement. But my argument does not depend upon its similarity to a stock purchase agreement. In fact, conceivably, they could have purchased the name alone, but as long as they have this language in there, they've agreed. They said it. This prong of our claim depends upon agreement. We think the agreement is perfectly plain, but we're willing to go in front of a jury and have them determine the meaning of the agreement as well. That's all I'm saying. And this does not imperil purchasers of assets in any way, shape, or form. You want to exclude liabilities? Put it in black and white, and God bless you. You're done. But that's not what they did here.
Is that ever in the real world actually done when a business is sold as a going concern?
It can be done. There can be carve-outs. There can be baskets. You can buy tail insurance. You can do all sorts of different things. The fact of the matter is,
really ever done in the real world? I'll take everything on the asset side of your balance sheet, but nothing on the liability side? That doesn't make any sense to me.
I believe that it can be done. You run a risk under some of the other exceptions. We're not talking about those now. But the fact is, what is at issue in front of this court is simply the intent of the parties. What did they agree to?
Counsel, if it were that simple, I'm wondering why we took the case. If this is such a unique provision of purchasing assets, this court generally, and I
indicate that generally don't take cases to interpret unique and unusual fact situations pertaining to only two parties and what they intended. Let me then ask the question with that preface, is this asset purchase agreement a rather standard in form asset purchase agreement?
Your Honor, I can't tell you.
If I were going to go back to my chambers and look up on the Internet and pull down some sample asset purchase agreements, is this going to, by and large, conform with those but for, you know, some of the things that are specific? And
I think it highly unlikely. I cannot tell you if there is even such a thing as a standard asset purchase agreement.
Well, your firm, you you've got a file folder as hard and on the computer. Okay. You go to, bing, as standard asset purchase agreement.
Well, the fact of the matter is, you know, they're a starting point and you choose one from column A and one from column B. I do not think, the one thing that I can say with some degree of certainty here is that regardless of whether this was standard at the time, I don't think it's standard now. This agreement was drafted in late 1959 or early 1960. That's worlds away. I mean, Dwight Eisenhower was in the White House when this agreement was drafted. I think hula hoops were having their first craze, back when this was drafted. This is eons ago. And Your Honor suggests, well, we don't take review for, nitty-gritty sorts of contract interpretation questions. Your Honor, to be quite honest, I don't know why. I do not see an issue here worthy of review. My point here is, I didn't ask you to review this case, you understand, not this aspect of the case. My point here is the Court of Appeals did exactly what they should have done. They looked at the contract, they attempted to determine the intent of the parties, and they said, it's ambiguous, send it back to the trial court for further proceedings. And that is the rule of law that should pertain in this case.
Were the liabilities at issue here outstanding in 1960?
Yes, Your Honor. And we discussed this in somewhat more detail, but outstanding is a word which is capable of simply meaning, unresolved. And in this case, and keep in mind, it's not just liabilities, it's obligations. There's a string of phrases that I think collectively is as broad an assumption as one can reasonably expect.
Well, is there no limit to the liabilities, then, that Madison Gas was assuming? For example, we have students here,
yes,
born long
yes,
after the agreement was made. If somehow one of these students died as a result of the contamination,
yes,
did Madison Gas assume that liability?
It's Wisconsin Gas, not Madison.
Wisconsin Gas.
The bottom line answer is yes. Is this a long tail of liability? Yes. Are the effects of the contamination long? Yes. This case, it's important to remember that this case involves the imposition of liability not because of anything that Wisconsin Gas did while on the premises. It's because they agreed, in essence, to step into the shoes of Peoples Gas. That's what they agreed. Now, they disagree right now that that's what they agreed, but that is the basis for liability in this case. We can argue about whether, in fact, they did so intend, but that argument can and should take place within the confines of the law as it currently exists. The Court of Appeals ruling does not in any way, shape, or form imperil the distinction between stock acquisitions and asset acquisitions. It's up to the parties to specify what their agreement is. And I think that when you look not only at the agreement itself, but all the facts and circumstances of this case, including the history leading up to it and the representations to the PSC,
What is the significance of the word then before the word outstanding, in the phrase then outstanding?
All of the then outstanding, blah, blah. then, I believe, refers to at the time of closing. See, the distinction here, it's important to remember, is that unlike the previous stock purchase agreement, here, Peoples Gas would continue to exist not only as an entity, but an entity not under Wisconsin Gas's control after closing. So in theory, you know, Wisconsin Gas could go out and incur some more liabilities. And because that was a possibility, I think, you know, they made amply certain that it was the date of closing that constituted the cutoff. You know, liability and obligations arising out of pre-closing operations assumed, post-closing acts, you know, liability and obligations arising out of that did not assume. And that, that I believe, is what that phrase means, Your Honor.
This isn't a post-closing liability for a pre-closing act.
Certainly there are consequences that extend the entire period. But the fact is that they assumed not only liabilities, but all obligations. And you have to look at this as though it's Peoples Gas. As of the date of closing, or, you know, the instant before closing, Peoples Gas had done something wrong. They'd contaminated the ground and the groundwater, and they had a duty to clean it up or pay the consequences. And that's what was assumed.
That didn't arise until 40 years later.
It wasn't discovered until 40 years later. But I believe it arose, and I think that if you look at GNB Battery, they say, where are you dealing with these sorts of assumptions? That type of language means the pre-closing acts, omissions, operations, et cetera. I'm sorry, may I respond to Judge Babbitt?
One quick question. You referred me to paragraph 1B when I asked you about where they accepted liabilities.
Yes.
The language, but the language in that refers to outstanding
yes.
liabilities. And the word outstanding, of course, it seems to me anyway, refers to liabilities that are then and there known. Why was this an outstanding liability at the time this contract was entered into?
Well, Your Honor, two responses to that. First, it is liabilities or obligations, a much broader term. And second, I must respectfully disagree with Your Honor that outstanding implies knowledge or listing on the balance sheet in any way. I do not believe that that implication arises whatsoever.
Well, let me just ask, should they have known the possibility of liability because there were laws on the books, and I don't know what was on the books in 1959-60, that would say people that had people in the business of Peoples Gas might very well be doing environmental damage?
Absolutely, yes.
Which
Absolutely.
Laws are they?
What's that?
What laws were they?
Well, first, there were nuisance laws and some other. I think in our brief, and forgive me, I think it's page 36 in a footnote, we list some statutes and some case law, some of it extending back into the 19th century, that shows that you can be liable for pollution. If you would bear with me for a moment.
Well, I agree, and pollution is an old standing public nuisance. It could be smoke, and we all know that. But what was there?
Groundwater.
Did you know that this kind of business was a pollution business?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There you need to check the affidavit of Betty Losey, which is record number 36. And I also believe it's somewhere near exhibits W, X, and Y in the affidavit of Michael Ash, which is record number 36A. And if you examine those, you will see that for many, many years before this, possibly extending back into the 19th century, the danger of pollution and byproducts from manufactured gas facilities, sometimes called coal gasification facilities, was well known not only in general, but to Wisconsin Gas, then known as Milwaukee Gas in particular. And in fact, Milwaukee Gas had its own coal gasification facilities in other locations, although it never actually ran this one. Certainly, they should have known of at least the possibility that there was a problem on this site.
Is that true of Wisconsin Gas Company, too? Should they have known?
Well, excuse me, I was speaking of Wisconsin Gas. Certainly People's Gas should have known as well. I mean, this is
both
should have known, yes.
Are there any other questions?
I thank you very much for your attention, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel, for your presentation. And, Mr. Armstrong, you have another presentation.
I'd like to address the term outstanding that's been raised by several members of the court. I mean, that really governs the contract interpretation issue. What is an outstanding liability in the context of an asset purchase agreement in which the buyer is governed by the rule of law that one does not assume liability unless he expressly says so? Outstanding, we submit, Your Honors, does not mean unknown. Outstanding, certainly, and we've referenced a dictionary definition, it means to stand out. It is prominent. It is known. And there's a further reason why the word outstanding means known in the context of this case, and that is paragraph 7 of the asset purchase agreement. Wisconsin Gas agreed to assume only those liabilities of Peoples for which Peoples had insurance coverage. That is undisputed. That was a condition to the assumption of liability. Does Peoples Gas have insurance coverage for the liability being assumed? And the reason the word outstanding must mean known is no one could possibly state that one has insurance coverage for unknown liabilities. That's an impossibility. What it would mean here is that Peoples Gas was telling Wisconsin Gas, we have insurance coverage that it goes back 40 years for any action or inaction on our part, regardless of how great the damage it may have caused, whether it be environmental contamination or the sale of a defective product, we're going to have insurance coverage for that. That, I submit, is absurd. No seller and no buyer would agree to rely upon a representation by a seller that I have insurance coverage no matter what I do.
Let me ask this. Doesn't the comprehensive general liability policy really contemplate coverage for unknown liabilities?
Well, I think an insurance policy may cover a liability that's unknown. We don't know whether, in this case, we don't know whether people's had any insurance at all, quite frankly. But what's being represented here to Wisconsin Gas as an inducement to this deal is that Wisconsin Gas, we're either adjusting our liabilities on the balance sheet, or the liabilities that are being transferred to you, you don't have to worry about because we have adequate insurance. The fact that you have a general liability policy wouldn't mean that the policy would cover everything. Certainly, we have many cases in which an insurance company is going to deny liability for various reasons. We also don't know whether an insurance policy, if there was one, a comprehensive liability policy, would have reached back to the commission of contamination back in 1925 or 1930. So it's impossible for a seller and a buyer to agree, as was the case here, for $105,000. Wisconsin Gas was not going to assume liabilities, as Justice Abrahamson pointed out, in a personal injury context, could run into the millions of dollars, perhaps more, if there were a death due to this contamination. This agreement quite specifically says Wisconsin Gas is accepting only liabilities of Peoples Gas that are insured by Peoples. And those were contingent liabilities, as I say, that were referenced in paragraph 7 of the agreement. Now, with respect to the fish exception, I think the reason Judge Rogan's Act dissented in this case, the majority of the Court of Appeals did not say they found the term outstanding ambiguous. The majority of the Court of Appeals found that there was ambiguity not because of that term, but because of the exclusionary language further back in the agreement. That is, we specifically exclude any liability incurred after closing. The majority of the Court of Appeals also referenced the insurance provision as creating an ambiguity. I believe Judge Rogenczak was correct in stating that that is contrary to Fish. Fish does not allow, in an asset purchase context, one to look at exceptions or other provisions of the agreement where the assumption of liability provision itself is not ambiguous. And there is no claim, there was no finding by the Court of Appeals majority that the term outstanding was ambiguous standing alone. They referenced these two other provisions. And as we point out in our brief, it was belt and suspenders. When you say you're assuming a certain liability, you're disclaiming all others. So when the agreement says that we disclaim any liabilities incurred after closing, that would be redundant even under Columbia Propane's proffered interpretation of the agreement, i.e., we are assuming all pre-closing liabilities. Secondly, the majority of the Court of Appeals also referenced the insurance provision. And the majority stated, well, we're confused because why would there be any need to state anything other than what's on the balance sheet with respect to insurance? That means that there are liabilities that aren't on the balance sheet. Well, that's true. There were two liabilities here that were not on the balance sheet. Those were known liabilities, and they were contingent. Those were the two accidents referred to in paragraph 7 of the asset purchase agreement. There is no way that a reasonable interpretation of this agreement can result in the assumption of unknown liabilities, because Wisconsin Gas conditioned its acceptance of any assumption on there being insurance coverage. And that representation and warranty was given by Peoples. We warrant, we guarantee to you that we have coverage for the liabilities you're assuming.
May I ask a question? What application does this case have to standard asset purchase agreements rather than this individual?
This particular case?
Yes.
Well, Your Honor, I believe the answer to that is under Fish and under the progeny of Fish, the rule of law is that an asset purchaser can take comfort in the fact that it's purchasing assets, it's not engaging in a stock deal, so we're only going to be held liable for those liabilities expressly assumed in the agreement. We're not going to be held that, oh, there's an ambiguity somewhere else in the agreement, so it's all going to go to the jury. In this case, the only reason there was any ambiguity found by the Court of Appeals had nothing to do with the assumption of liability provision, the word outstanding. In fact, the majority said, you know, if it weren't for these two other things, we'd agree. That's not ambiguous. You didn't assume unknown liabilities. The majority of the Court of Appeals said that there was ambiguity because there was an exclusion, which I've stated is simply belt and suspenders anyway, and the insurance provision. And I think the policy here is that a court is not allowed to look, examine other portions of the agreement to try to find ambiguity. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Casey, Mr. Armstrong, and Mr. Apfeld, for your arguments today on a very interesting and difficult case. So that concludes our hearing on 01-0090 Columbia Propane versus Wisconsin Gas Company. And the students will return at noon, and Justice Crooks will meet with them. Anyone else here who would like to attend that session is certainly welcome to do so. We are in recess until, and is it a 1:45? Until 1:45 for our second case today.
Mr. Jones?